Good evening. Sammy is coming. So we have a new face tonight. Or you've been here before.
Once.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I've forgotten your name.
Susan.
So easy. Let's do introductions around.
Julie.
Dan.
Randy.
Russ.
Samuel. Fred. Susan.
Lauren.
Angie. So we've come to the end of, almost to the end of Suzuki Roshi for the moment. Don't think we'll ever abandon this book. It's part of our bones and blood. We grew up on it. But we've come to the epilogue, which is quite long. Before we start to read, though, I wanted to talk about practice period shortly and what we do next. I've been thinking about it all week. Dan's suggestion was very helpful. Donna Lynn had some good ones, too. What I would like to do is take the book that you, or the work that you suggested, Now I've forgotten which one it is.
Zui Monkey,
which you can find online at the Soto Zen headquarters, all translated and printed out in very short paragraphs, mostly just one or two paragraphs, statements that Dogen made to his monks. Some of them are very monkey. Very, very much about living in a monastery, I mean, and probably aren't too relevant for us. What I thought I'd do is choose some, one for each evening, and we can do the same thing that we did with this book, read it through and discuss it. And I'd like to choose things that will help us perhaps in our practice period, because that's beginning at the same time. So we can start focusing our practice a bit more and finding some inspiration in Dogen. And then at the last couple of meetings, we have... If we start on the 8th of July, we'll have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 meetings before Sesshin. So I thought the last two I'd take up Fukan Zazengi, or one of the ones that are just completely about Zazen, since we're going to be sitting for a week. It seems like a good idea to refresh ourselves and completely focus on that subject. So I'm going on a camping trip on Friday, and I'm going to take the book. Thomas Cleary has a translation of it also, the Zui Monkey. And it's a very good translation, so if you like to have a book you can carry around, I'm going to take it with me in my backpack and choose the ones, and then I'll let you know next time which ones we're going to do. Dan?
Venerable, logistics around that. Can we publish as a lesson plan on the website, maybe, which ones those are, so people can either...
Of course, we can.
...either preview them or bring printed copies if they want, you know, some...
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good... Okay.
Great idea. Yeah. Yeah. And then, as I said last week, if you all start thinking of what you can... choose to do that's extra sitting, you know, another 10 minutes of sitting in the morning or memorizing the Heart Sutra. That's always a good idea. Learning to do the Doan and the Kokyo, that's another one too. That's a very nice thing to learn how to do for practice period. Anything that gives you a sense of expanding your connection with practice and deepening it at the same time. I'll be available for Doksan once off and on. We won't be having a one-day sit or a half-day sit for Doksans until the 5th of August. 12th? 12th of August. 9th of August. 9th.
There's no sitting in July?
Yes. I won't be here in July.
Okay. Oh, I see. So there's no Doksan.
There won't be Doksan in July, but there will be in August. But I'm available, so I'm available to sit in the park or take a walk or have dinner or have tea at my house, any and all of the above. So please feel free to call and make a date. So shall we begin to read the epilogue?
Zen mind. Before the rain stops, we can hear a bird. Even under the heavy snow, we see snowdrops and some new growth. Here in America, we cannot define Zen Buddhists the same way we do in Japan. American students are not priests and yet not completely laymen. I understand it this way, that you are not priest in an easy matter, but that you are not exactly laymen is more difficult. I think you are special people and want some special practice. It is not exactly priest's practice and not exactly layman's practice. You are on your way to discovering some appropriate way of life. I think that is our Zen community, our group.
But we must also know that our undivided original way is. But we must also know what our original, undivided original way is and what Dogen's practice is. Dogen Zenji said that some may attain enlightenment and some may not. This is a point I am very much interested in. Although we have the same fundamental practice which we carry out in the same way, some may attain enlightenment and some may not. It means that even if we have no experience of enlightenment, if we sit in the proper way with the right attitude and understanding of practice, then that is Zen. The main point is to practice seriously, and the important attitudes to understand and have confidence in big mind.
We say big mind or small mind or Buddha mind or Zen mind, and these words mean something, you know, but something we cannot and should not try to understand in terms of experience. We talk about enlightenment experience, but it is not some experience we will have in terms of good or bad, time or space, past or future. It is experience or consciousness beyond those distinctions or feelings. So we should not ask, what is enlightenment experience? That kind of question means you do not know what Zen experience is. Enlightenment cannot be asked for in your ordinary way of thinking. When you are not involved in this way of thinking, you have some chance of understanding what Zen experience is.
The big mind in which we must have confidence is not something which you can experience objectively. It is something which is always with you, always on your side. Your eyes are on your side, for you cannot see your eyes, and your eyes cannot see themselves. Eyes only see outside, objective things. If you reflect on yourself, that self is not your true self anymore. You cannot project yourself as some objective thing to think about. The mind which is always on your side is not just on your mind. It is the universal mind, always the same. that different from another's mind. It is Zen mind. In the big, big mind, the mind is always what you see. The true mind is always with whatever you see. Although you do not know your own mind, it is there. At the very moment you see something, it is there. This is very interesting. The mind is always with the things you observe. So you see the mind is at the same time everything.
True mind is watching mind. We cannot say, this is myself, my small mind, or my limited mind, and that is big mind. That is limiting yourself, restricting your true mind, objectifying your mind. Bodhidharma said, in order to see a fish, you must watch the water. Actually, when you see water, you see the true fish. Before you see Buddha nature, you watch your mind. When you see the water, there is true nature. True nature is watching water. When you say, my zazen is very poor, here you have true nature, but foolishly you do not realize it. You ignore it on purpose. There is immense importance in the I with which you watch your mind. That I is not the big I. It is the I which is incessantly active, always swimming, always flying through the vast air with wings. By wings I mean thought and activity. The vast sky is home, my home. There is no bird or air. When the fish swims, water and fish are the fish. There is nothing but fish. Do you understand? You cannot find Buddha nature by vivisection. Reality cannot be caught by thinking or feeling one. Moment after moment, to watch your breathing, to watch your posture, is true nature. There is no secret beyond this point.
We Buddhists do not have any idea of material only, or mind only, or the products of our mind, or mind as an attribute of being. What we are always talking about is that mind and body, mind and material, are always one. But if you listen carelessly, it sounds as if we are talking about some attribute of being, or about material, or spiritual. That will be a version of it, maybe. But actually we are pointing out mind which is always on this side, which is true mind. Enlightenment experience is to figure out, to understand, to realize this mind which is always with us and which we cannot see. Do you understand? If you try to attain enlightenment as if you see a bright star in the sky, it will be beautiful, and you may think, ah, this is enlightenment. But that is not enlightenment. That understanding is literally heresy. Even though you do not know it, in that understanding, you have the idea of material only. Dozens of your enlightenment spirits experiences are like that. Some material only, some object of your mind, as if through good practice you found that bright star. That is the idea of self and object. It is not the way to seek for enlightenment.
Well, we could stop here and do the rest next week. Otherwise, we won't have any time at all to talk. Let's do that. Somebody sent me an article about Tiger Woods. The article was about how Tiger Woods, and I've forgotten the name of the man who was playing against him in this last big championship. And the man he was playing against, as they walked across the green for that last dramatic moment, was looking around and acknowledging the crowd and smiling and sort of having a great time. And Tiger Woods was walking with his head down, just looking at the grass and not noticing anything on either side. And the journalist wrote and said, I bet Tiger Woods is thinking all the time about how he's going to play the next play. And that's why he's not looking around. And he's very smart to do that because he's in his head. He's thinking real hard about how to do the next thing. And I thought, oh no, I doubt it. I think he was probably in doing Zen, that he wasn't thinking at all. He was simply being in his body as his body and being completely focused on being what that is. That's just Zazen. It was very beautiful. I read about it. I wish I'd seen it. I don't like golf at all, but I like to watch Tiger Woods because he has that kind of... it's not just a focus and it's not just an attitude, but it's a whole body in the world. Very unusual practice, I think he has. And I think that's what Suzuki Roshi is talking about here, about enlightenment, and we think of it as some kind of fabulous idea. But the truth is, it's dropping all the ideas. Being willing to just be this astonished animal that we are. And proceed. Fearlessly proceed. We're always trying to know something. And yet I think what draws us to this is the unknown and the unknowable. And as he says here, it's really untalkaboutable as well. And yet we can sit here and acknowledge it strangely as a kind of living force of us. This whole question of priests and lay is still going on, probably for another five generations or so. The Soto school in America can't make up their minds. Some people do priest ordination for lay people and give them a different color rakusu. They give them a green rakusu instead of a blue one or a black one. So then that means it's lay, but it's priest. So I think poor Suzuki Roshi just didn't know how to deal with any of that, and I don't think we do either in this generation. And in the most profound sense, it doesn't really isn't so important. We find our ways of commitment, and in the biggest sense, as Sangha, we inspire each other by our sense of commitment. What we call that isn't so important. And yet, it's wonderful to take the precepts. It's wonderful to give the precepts, so-called. Every time the precepts come up again, it's a wonderful moment. So that's the only important thing in my mind. We just keep doing that over and over. there's time for discussion. We have big mind and small mind in here too, which is kind of his signature. He's the only teacher I know who ever talked about it in terms of big mind and small mind. It bewildered me when I first read this book. I didn't know what he meant. Lauren?
I have a silly question. Maybe silly questions are okay too. I happened to go to Mary Kate Spencer's memorial, and one of the things that I think I overheard people talking about was there were, of course, people there from lots of different meditation institutions, like even wider than that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that came up was someone said about, you know, one of the things that distinguishes one sitting group from another is whether it's okay to wear socks in the Zen room. So,
I see.
You know anything about this? I've heard, well, in stuff I've read, things I've read about, you know, in monks in Japan in the winter wear socks in the Zendo.
White socks. Yes, they have to be white socks.
Oh, they have to be white socks.
Yes, they're very strict about that. But they do, that's true. It's cultural, all those things. So it's about the discipline of practice. So if you join a group, then you accept whatever the culture is, and if you join another group, then you have to change and do something else. So it's those things are just helps, but there's no universal law about what you wear on your feet. Or anywhere else. It's a very funny statement. Samia?
I met a gentleman that runs a monastery in New Mexico. He was an excellent, and he was a spiritual director, and he was given after sitting a Dharma talk. And a question came up, and I don't know how it came about, and with the conversation, he goes, well, I'm not enlightened, you know. And I kept thinking about this. It's like, what makes somebody enlightened, and how do you know, and who decides? And I argued with him for a long time afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, isn't that a judgment? To me, you are. You know, when you're given a talk and it's going right through, and, you know, it's making sense. But then later I thought, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But to me it seemed that way. When something makes sense, and if a human being has dedicated his life to become a leader of a very small monastery out in Timbuktu. So what's your thoughts on that?
It's a very narrow way of looking. It can be a very narrow way of looking. When Buddha was enlightened, he said, all beings are enlightened with me. So it isn't that you get something from the outside that makes you special. It's that you are freed to see others as they are. So it's about each one of us. It's not about other people. It's about how we can see how things are without clouding our vision. are being blocked by our own self-absorption. So it's, you know, in Zen we say sitting is enlightenment itself. So everyone who is sitting is Buddha. And if you have the Buddha eye, you see everyone walking around as Buddha also. So there's not a question of this one's enlightened and this one is not. On another level, you can also say that sometimes you see someone as Buddha, and you can see that same person as an ordinary person at another time. That we all pass in and out of Buddha-ness, you could say, of being clouded up and then being clear. And we respond to the clarity in other people, and it creates our own clarity. We recognize it because it's us. That clarity is what Buddha is. And we call it enlightened. It's light. But there are a lot of problems that come up with that whole subject, because then people start to, you know, elevate some people and or elevate themselves, which is even more serious. And I always say, if you meet somebody who calls himself enlightened, run away. It's
yeah, I think he was trying to go the other way.
Yes. Very wisely.
And then I had this reaction, and I was like, no. who do you think you are to call yourself unenlightened? And he said, well, how would I have put it in a different way? I said, well, I don't know, but maybe that your answer to that person's question is that how you would see it, and just leave it at that. Why do we have, why did he have to put a label or even... And maybe he said that because of the question. But it was okay to challenge somebody not to put that label on themselves?
Sure. Sure. He was probably happy.
He fought it.
Yeah.
He fought it.
Well, that's what a good student does. Backs the teacher right up into a corner. Good work.